to be back in this space with this group. So I was raised in the ticky-tacky suburbs of the San Francisco Bay Area. And in the summer times, my family would come out to visit our grandparents in Richland County. And so summer after summer, I developed a certain sense of knowledge, wonder, and some family myths that came about from being a fifth generation of a European settler. So I have this sort of California-Wisconsin bifurcation, but with a certain deeper sense of adult knowledge about a particular sense of place. So before I start some formal remarks, I wanted to give you all a chance to talk a little bit about some impressions that relate to the topic today. So if over the next 5 minutes or so, you could just talk to someone next to you about one of the following or three of the following questions or something related to them. So one question would be, how much do you know about your own family's journey to Wisconsin, since all of us are essentially immigrants here? Do you regard Wisconsin as home, and why or why not? And what would you like to learn more about your own family's past? So I'm going to give you 2 minutes each to share some initial responses to those questions, and then we will plunge into the topic of the day. I want to get just two or three responses to a particular conversation group. What was kind of the anything interesting or anything that jumped out at you in the conversations that you had with your partner or partners? Yeah.
We moved here 25 years ago from California and Utah, and it still doesn't feel like home.
Interesting.
I was born and raised here, but just kind of home to her, but 25 years in.
Yeah, this question had to do, or this response had to do with people coming from to Wisconsin from Western states, and there's the kind of unspoken period of when you become official or when you're accepted as an outsider and still not feeling completely at home in Wisconsin. Any other comment? Yeah.
My conversation partner and I both discovered that we came to Wisconsin in utero. our mothers were both very pregnant with us each when they moved to Wisconsin. So that's the first time I've ever talked to somebody else who arrived that way.
What are the odds?
Yeah.
Any last comment? Yeah.
Well, Rand and I both, I guess, came to Wisconsin is one of our homes on Earth, but we have another one. We have just places we've been that spoke to us, or Grand Hawaii and Wisconsin.
You know, I was born and raised in Hawaii, but I moved back here because and stay here. My name's roots of my family, British ancestors, that settled originally in northern Wisconsin.
Interesting. So those last two comments, one had to do with two people moving, discovered that they each moved to Wisconsin in utero when their mothers came to Wisconsin originally, and then a couple who have feel a sense of place in multiple places, but one having a strong sort of homing instinct to Wisconsin because of his Finnish ancestry here. Well, thank you for sharing all of that, because it's very germane to what I'll be talking about today. So the background on our family farm, which we call Tipisaukee, which we're still trying to completely understand the origins of the name. We've consulted with the Ho-Chunk. They don't recognize it. The Meskwaki, who also had roots in Southwest Wisconsin, don't recognize it. So it may be, maybe it's an Anglo invention, but it's supposed to be a beautiful place to live in the family lore. First off, how many of you, there's, wanted to get a slide up of the map of Wisconsin, just to get people oriented. How many of you are familiar with the term the Driftless Area, the southwest corner? Good. So that unique unglaciated part of Wisconsin, which is very much about, you know, the setting of our particular farm, right on the lower Wisconsin River, kind of between Muscadet and Boscobel. And so the natural history is very much a part of the setting. My grandparents, at one point when they were coming to the kind of late in life, they approached the Wisconsin Historical Society about perhaps donating the farm to the Historical Society, and the Historical Society said, yeah, we'd like to dismantle the farm and move it to Eagle, Wisconsin, to be part of Old World Wisconsin. And end of discussion, that was not gonna happen. So the farm is very much based, it's right on the lower Wisconsin River. It has the bluffs in the background and sandy soil produced by the receding waters of the glaciers that accumulated en masse up near Devil's Lake, finally ruptured, and that mass of water rushing down the river valley was what created those bluffs and laid down the sand and gravel that's part of our farm. So we very much go back to that in 12,000 years at least, to the creation of this land. We've done some, we're also wanting to honor the archaeological history of the area, since there was a Ho-Chunk village on the property. And on the next slide, it gives you a sense of the view from a hill where the farmhouse is, we'll see later, looking down to the kind of the far right end of that pasture is where the Ho-Chunk village would have resided. It was a seasonal village. Ho-Chunk would have spent the winter in caves up above on the bluffs, and then come down and cultivated their crops and used the river for their extensive trade networks. So we know that there was, we know from archaeological records that were done by the Historical Society in 93, 94, that there was a Meskwaki presence on the property probably in the late 1800s, and then Ho-Chunk presence in the early 19th century. So we know that there was indigenous habitation on that property, and that there's more that the soil could tell if we get to that point. We also want to at some point learn the Ho-Chunk version of the creation and the inhabitation of their peoples on this land. It also sits in a part of the valley where there are petroglyphs, there are effigy mounds in abundance. So there's a whole cultural landscape piece that we are a recent and very small part of. The European settler who was our great-great-grandfather came from southwest England. We knew that there was an agricultural crisis in, you know, similar to the Irish potato famine. There were land tenure issues that led poor farmers not to be able to really make ends meet. And so he was a part of a wave of people that left the harbor of Bude in kind of in the Cornwall Devonshire border of southwest England and try to come to the Americas. So he ended up coming through Ohio, was late to a land rush there, and then moved on, spent some time in the Galena lead mines, and then finally when the last of the Indian treaties were signed in 1837, he learned about this particular property and ended up being the first European settler in Richland County. And that was part of the lore that our grandmother taught us, was the first white settler in Richland County, which to us as, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-olds sounded like kind of a glorious past, but we've come to learn more about the backstory over the years. Because of the care and stewardship of multiple generations of our family, we have the benefit of five historic buildings from the 19th century. And the farm itself is pretty much in the configuration of a 19th century farm, in terms of where the pastures, the woods, and the historic structures sit. So it's really like a trip back in time. So we were able to work with a University of Wisconsin landscape architecture professor to get a designation on the National Register of Historic Places in the mid-1990s. And so it does have that moral, if not legal, categorization as a rural historic district. So lots and lots of the natural and architectural elements contribute to the historic nature of the property. So that's part of what we're trying to maintain. So if you look at the there's the old farmhouse there that was built in two phases. The lower portion would have been the 1860s portion, and then the two-story section would have been the 1880s, kind of reflective of the increased prosperity of the farmer over time, increased access to income. So if you look at the some of the outbuildings, there's one that's a 1861 horse and threshing barn that can enable, you know, skilled eye will be able to see the elements of the wheat, the period of time when wheat was king in Wisconsin agriculture. And then we have a 1950s dairy barn that's not in use anymore. And you can kind of see the evolution of Wisconsin agriculture. And then if you add in the crops that would have been grown on the front pasture by Ho-Chunk or Meskwaki people, you can kind of see that whole trajectory over centuries. In one of the things that we had kind of a labor of love that we look back on very fondly was a symposium that we were able to put together with a lot of other partners in 2003. So we were able to get, you see the document there, and I'm going to leave a copy here for the church, the library. It was lots of different experts who came together, and we had a number of Ho-Chunk representatives helping plan this two-day event. So a lot of it was talking head plenaries and workshops about the encounter and conflict of Native peoples with European settlers. And we had people talking about the natural history of the property, the history of barns, what it was like to archive some of the materials that still exist on the property, some of the Ho-Chunk telling their stories of forced relocation, as well as a workshop on Ho-Chunk humor, which was had a couple of presenters poking fun at each other's clans. So it was this really incredible kind of undertaking. It took about 4 years to pull off, and we had partners with UW Richland, the Lower Wisconsin Riverway Board, the Ho-Chunk Nation, and others to pull this off. And it concluded with field visits to the Ho-Chunk Nation farm in Muscadet and to our farm in Blue River. So one of the descriptions, there's a Wisconsin historian who described, or a historic preservationist who described the event this way. So the event was extraordinary in several ways. First, so many of the leading scholars of Wisconsin history and archaeology were gathered in one place at one time. Equally significant, white scholars and Native American tradition bearers gathered to discuss the history of conflict between their peoples. And finally, the meeting derived a sense of power from its immediacy. It brought together the current owners of the Tipisaugi farm, who are direct descendants of the English settler John Coombe, and the Ho-Chunk partners in the symposium. Then at a more personal level, there was an interesting encounter at the end of the formal portion of the symposium where my wife posed a question to the cultural affairs officer of the Ho-Chunk had talked about her personal experience. And my wife, whose name is Nuria, asked Suzette Lemaire, the presenter, after so many years of suffering, what do the Ho-Chunk think can be done in the future to help heal the wounds of the past and continue to build bridges to the future? Suzette responded, the Ho-Chunk people have been survivors since the beginning of time, and we have a big heart. That is one of our cultural ways. Whenever somebody hurts our feelings, many, many years ago, the practice was to cook some food or to take a gift, moccasins or beadwork, that you had made. The person who had been hurt takes the gift over to the doorstep of the person who hurt him. And this is a way of saying, it's okay. We all have a goal of finding our way back home, getting back to the Creator. It's easy to forgive. So just respect us as we respect you. So these are some of the learnings that we gleaned through this very intensive two-day symposium, a lot of which the formal and some of the informal contents of that workshop are replicated in about 170 pages of different readings and publications there. So what about the future? So we've benefited from five generations of family stewardship of the property, of the land, of the buildings, of the artifacts, garments, documents. My brother Ben, we took over ownership from our mom in about 10 years ago. We currently lease out fields and pastures to area farmers to maintain what would have been the agriculture component minus the milking of the cows. In 2014, we developed a management plan for the two woodlots on the property. And so thank you for keeping ahead of me on the slides. So this is a part of the woods that we're beginning to open up to favor oak regeneration. And this happens to be a grove of river birches that's particularly nice late in the day with the soft golden light of the afternoon coming into these river birches. So forest management is part of what we're trying to do with an eye towards recreation, but also ecological health. In last year, we did a formal presentation to Ho-Chunk Gaming Madison, and kind of midway, they were generally responsive, and midway through the business director, a guy named John, said, this is all well and good, but what is your ask? So perfect for a business director to say. And we said, really, we don't have an ask at this point. We'd like to explore ways that we can tell the European settler story and the Ho-Chunk story in tandem, whatever way that turns out to be. So that was kind of an interesting revelation into his thinking. And then based on that meeting, we had a visit to the property from the cultural preservation officer of the Ho-Chunk up in Black River Falls. And he came down and had a meal with us, and we walked a bit of the property. He was very interested in the spring area where the Ho-Chunk village would have accessed water, and the white settler as well. And I hadn't known this, but there are sort of three levels to the Ho-Chunk world, and there's the sky, there's the land, and then there's the underworld, and the access to the subterranean is through the springs. So it was interesting to see him spend so much time looking in and around the spring area. We also confessed to him that we were cognizant of our great-great-grandfather's role in urging the army to relocate the Ho-Chunk west of the Mississippi. And this guy, Bill, just was not particularly interested in dwelling on that. He said, you know, they were all products of their time. And so he was more interested in the current and the future. So we explored the woods with him. We did offer to use the woods as a place for encounters for young people who might be coming on canoe trips down the river, to be able to come and stay over, camp out, do storytelling around the campfire, do a sweat lodge, whatever they want to do with it. We also asked if they would be interested in available to help us learn how to better steward our woods. Received a positive response to that. So we've also created a Friends of the Firearm Organization. We're using the Cross Currents name. So it's the Friends of the Cross Currents Heritage Center. This, we'll have, be having our inaugural board meeting in October. And we're creating a conservation easement to try to protect the rural character of the land in perpetuity. So even if the land were ultimately sold, it could never be developed. It could always have to retain the woods or historical portions or just the agricultural land. And we're doing that in concert with the farmer in the area who's been farming it for many decades and is interested in passing on the fields to his setting up his son in agriculture. So trying to maintain that look, because we know what second home development looks like to our east, and we know what a gravel and sand pit looks like to our west, and we're trying to forestall expansions of both. So that's where we sit in this kind of side-by-side succession planning, the farmer and us, and trying to reach out and engage with the Ho-Chunk. One of the things that this historian who was at the symposium and summed up our couple of days together said, he said, during these 2 days, we have heard the facts and interpretations that have demonstrated to us the intricacies of the patterns of human interaction in a rich landscape. We have learned how Native Americans and European Americans alike have changed that landscape, each in their own ways, through agriculture, hunting and fishing, and the creation of transportation systems. And we've learned that the quest for complete comprehension of this area is far from being realized. These kinds of lessons, I believe, should be taught around the entire United States in symposia like these. Said, one thing we know for certain is that Tipisaki is a talisman and a touchstone that has much more to tell us. So with that, we are trying to figure out what interinstitutional arrangements we need to, you know, who we need to partner with, certainly historical societies, the Ho-Chunk, educational, school districts, history buffs, birders. We need to ask ourselves what sustainability looks like to try to maintain this as a nonprofit educational resource for the community. And what does the partnership mean with white allies, is the common term, and the Ho-Chunk. One of the terms that I've often go back to in Spanish is acompañamiento. So how do we accompany them on a journey with them, helping lead that discovery and bringing the two stories together so that hopefully Wisconsin natives, educators, school children can have a better sense of what really went on in leading us to where we are today for the good, the bad, the ugly. So that is kind of the journey that we're on, and I'm happy to talk with you more over coffee afterwards, and thanks for your attention and your participation.